We have a moral obligation to many of these refugees who are now afoot in the world because they've left their countries because of us, because of the wars that we have started, because of the drugs that we buy, and because of the mess that we've made of the climate.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm Rebecca Frankel, FP's executive editor for print, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in Washington today. With me in the studio is FP's deputy editor for news, Keith Johnson. And joining us by phone is Suketu Mehta. Suketu is the New York-based author of Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found, and associate professor of journalism at NYU. Currently, he's working on a nonfiction book about immigrants in contemporary New York. Also calling in over Skype is Becca Heller. Becca is the director and co-founder of the International Refugee Assistance Project and a visiting lecturer at Yale Law School. Today, we're talking about immigration, more specifically about the pieces Suketu and Becca contributed to the September-October edition of FP's print magazine. Suketu's feature essay, This Land is Their Land, turns what is at times a brutal gaze on the West's fear of migrants and that fear's corrosive effect on modern society in America and Europe. In the magazine's back page, The Final Word, Becca shares her view on what a just immigration policy in the United States should look like. Suketu, Becca, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you for having us.
And to Keith. I'm always thankful Keith is in the
studio,
too. So today we're going to talk about immigration. It was a driving theme in our print issue to which you both contributed what I would say were two of the most impassioned and also provocative pieces on the topic. And we certainly got comments and feedback from our readers on that, which I will bring up a little bit later. Diving right into the very gritty heart of the matter, Suketu, you write rather succinctly very early on in the piece that the West is being destroyed, not by migrants, but by the fear of migrants. And I wanted to ask you both, Suketu, you first, where does that fear come from?
So I've been traveling a lot through Europe, and I live in America, and this is what I've been noticing, just a tremendous paranoia about migrants. And the fear actually comes from this idea of being replaced. That phrase you hear throughout Europe and America coming from the mouths of white nationalists. They were yelling it in the rallies in Charlottesville, we will not be replaced. There was actually a French book called The Great Replacement, which came out a few years ago, which has this idea that the French white population will be replaced all at once by hordes of migrants coming from the South, mainly Muslims. So it's a fear of essentially white nationalists in these countries who in the last few years have seen their wages drop, their suicide rates rise. So at this point, some of the highest suicide rates in America are middle-aged white men. And so it is a legitimate fear, and it needs to be addressed. These are people who, for much of the 20th century, control the world, and they still control much of the world in the 21st century. But they see that their children don't have the same opportunities that they do. Hence, Trump gets elected, and in Europe, you know, Orban gets elected. In country after country, you see the nationalists get elected. And behind the nationalists are very powerful interests that use immigrants as scapegoats. So something I point out in my article is that there's eight men who now control more wealth than half of the planet combined, that is 3.6 billion people own the same as eight men. So there's an outrage at inequality in all these countries, and the safest way for wealthy elites in these countries to channel the outrage is to direct it at the migrants and say, blame them, not us. But if you were to look at most economists, you know, the vast majority of economists, they show that immigration is beneficial for these countries. There's a report that just came out that refugees to the United States brought in $63 billion more, that has contributed $63 billion more to the country than the amount of government services that was spent on them. But, you know, it's in the end, it's not a numbers-based argument. It's an emotional argument. And the people who are afraid of migrants are afraid that they, their race, their culture will be replaced by all these people who are on the move.
And Becca, are you seeing sort of or observing the same kind of reaction in the work that you've been doing since January in particular?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a podcast that you can't see my vigorous nodding with everything that my illustrious co-guest speaker just said. But I think that's absolutely what's happening, is that you have this sort of alt-right white nationalist political group that wants to scapegoat an other so that there's someone to blame for economic and other sorts of problems. I mean, this isn't new. I'm Jewish. Jews are pretty familiar with this happening, you know, prior to World War II. And the easiest other to scapegoat is always the new guy. And I think you can look at Americans and say, you know, who's the immigrant that doesn't deserve to be here? Who's the refugee that doesn't deserve to be here? Oh, it's the one that was on the boat right behind your ancestor. It's an arbitrary line to draw. And I think it's particularly unfortunate because not only do I not think that refugees and immigrants are people that we should be afraid of, I think that they're people that we should want to come into this country. If you buy the baseline argument that economy is bad, that there's an opioid crisis, that we need to move away from manufacturing jobs and foster social entrepreneurship, then you have to say who should be making up the labor force. And the thing that I think is amazing about the refugees that we work with is that they're people who have been through these just horrific, horrific things, who have voted with their feet, so to speak, gotten across a border, which is an incredibly difficult thing to do, made it to America, and are fighting really hard to start over. And I think if you want a country, a democracy, a workforce made up of tenacious entrepreneurs who will work incredibly hard for forward progress, then you should be more open to letting in immigrants and refugees. I think it's just completely backwards to try to blame them for stagnation when they're actually, I think, a lot of what promotes innovation in this country.
I think that's a great point that you made, because both of the pieces actually speak about, you know, directly and indirectly, the economic benefits. But, you know, I just wanted to go back. Does this, I mean, you mentioned these are tenacious, hardworking, entrepreneurial people. I mean, doesn't that actually just sort of reinforce what Suketu was talking about with the fear of being replaced? I mean, if you had a sort of sense of entitlement that, you know, I don't have to go the extra mile, I'm still going to have the house and the car and the mortgage and the steady job and the pension plan without lifting a finger, and then you find sort of the Red Queen phenomenon and you have to run harder and harder just to stay in place. I mean, doesn't that very vibrancy of that immigrant community increase the level of backlash they could get?
Only if you buy into the completely BS myth that it's somehow zero sum, that, you know, that the economy has a certain number of jobs, and that if an immigrant gets one, someone who isn't an immigrant isn't going to get another, that social entrepreneurs don't actually generate job creation, that driving the economy forward in innovative ways isn't what America has to do to replace the manufacturing jobs that we've lost. I just think to assume that if I'm applying for something and an immigrant is applying for something, only one of us can get it, and that's the end of the story, is an incredible, ignorant oversimplification of how things actually work. Like, you can't look at it on the microcosm of one single job and one single job application. You have to be looking at it from the point of view. And again, this is ignoring the humanitarian argument entirely, but even from a purely economic perspective, you have to look at it from the point of view of the economy as a whole and say, economic growth creates jobs. What creates economic growth? And that benefits everybody.
Right. But the same arguments made about, for instance, trade policy. And if you look at the economy as a whole, NAFTA is a plus. If you look at very specific sectors and factories and individual jobs, it can be a minus. And it's this very inability to look at the macro picture or the economy as a whole or the labor market as a whole that has fed a lot of this nativist backlash. So, I mean, you and I can talk about the silly notion that there's a zero-sum economy, but in certain towns, in certain places where there are a limited number of jobs and they go to a certain community, I mean, I think I can understand why there would be this sort of sense, as Suketu was saying with the French book, this fear of wholesale replacement, like an entire class could be replaced. It just, I can understand to a certain extent, I think, this angst. My question is, how do you communicate this the benefits that can come from having a more vibrant economy, and not just the economy, not just the workforce, but to have other things too, additional culture, different kinds of food, cuisine, music, languages. It's a whole richer environment that's out there. But how do you make that argument? Because it hasn't obviously worked in the 2016 campaign. It's an uphill battle so far in 2017. How do you make that case?
I think there's a number of different ways to make it. I mean, I think one way to make it is that the towns that are losing jobs aren't losing them because immigrants are coming in. They're losing them because jobs are going out, right? So I think coal is sort of a quintessential example of this. And it was brought up quite a bit in the 2016 campaign that, you know, betting on coal is betting on a losing industry. It's not actually that many jobs, but you do have this, you know, coal belt of voters who are losing their jobs and who are afraid of that. Are they losing them because immigrants and refugees are coming in and taking them? No, they're losing them because the energy sector is moving in different directions. Is it really complicated to make that argument? Yes. The other thing to note about refugees in particular is that refugees don't settle to U.S. towns arbitrarily. They're actually, there's a pretty complex, deliberate system of where refugees are assigned that in fact takes the local job market into account. So the majority of towns that receive refugees are towns that want refugees. They've expressed a desire for refugees. Oftentimes they have jobs that other people won't take that refugees are willing to take. This includes, you know, a meatpacking plant in Nebraska that resettled a ton of refugees to that town and was able to keep the plant from being taken overseas. I don't think that masses of immigrants are converging on towns with really high unemployment, because I think that immigrants want to go to places where jobs are available. And a number of studies have found that even towns that, you know, feel that they're anti-refugee or might be in locations where you would think that people of color or people from different cultures might not be tolerated, are really happy when they get refugee resettlement programs because it adds such a rich fabric to the town. I think not just in terms of concrete cultural things like food and art, but I think there's a lot of reasons why diversity and pluralism strengthen democratic institutions in a pretty fundamental way.
I completely agree. And I think one way to look at this whole debate about immigration is the urban-rural divide. So cities that have a lot of immigrants, places where people interact with immigrants in their daily lives, like New York City, are extremely immigrant-friendly. In fact, their mayors have declared these cities as sanctuary cities. 2 out of 3 New Yorkers today are immigrants or their children. And Mayor Bloomberg, I believe when he was a Republican, went up to Capitol Hill and said, if it had not been for immigration of all kinds, legal and illegal, the economy of New York would have collapsed after 9/11. So I think a lot of the resistance to immigration is coming from places like Iowa, where they either don't have a lot of immigrants or only have one kind of immigrants. But places where there's a diversity of immigrants from all over, no one gets scapegoated because everyone has experience of everyone else. And you see in your daily interactions with people that, you know, we are all here for the same reason, to make a better life for our children, to contribute to the national economy, and not to pillage and rape as some of the politicians describe us. The same sort of dynamic applies in Europe. The resistance to Brexit, a lot of it, was about immigration. Not just Muslims and Africans coming in, but also Romanians and Poles. And a lot of the resistance came from the countryside, places which didn't have a lot of experience with migrants. And the city of London was overwhelmingly against Brexit because they knew the practical benefits of immigration in the day-to-day life. So the more people experience immigrants directly, personally, the more in favor they are of immigrant-friendly politicians.
And Becca, you speak to that in your piece. You say that, you know, in the United States, we've allowed the rhetoric to become so polarized that people aren't able to see the connection between, you know, Americans living in the Rust Belt who are struggling to try and afford rising healthcare or are dealing with job losses to, you know, be able to relate to the experience that immigrants have or refugees have trying to come over to seek, you know, as you say, better opportunity to contribute in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, as trite as it sounds, we have much more in common than separates us.
So where does the divide get crossed? Because it would seem, certainly in the if we wanted to sort of dive into the Trump administration and the policies that are, Keith just shivered, that are getting pushed out. We were all listening to the UN speeches here in the office this week and listening to Trump talk to other nations and to hear him say, you should put your countries first. You should put your people first. And that was his way, I think, of justifying, and you know, his own nationalism and America first policies. And you know, Suketu, in your piece, you talk about Trump's July speech in Poland and the problems with that. And what messages do you think are reinforced? Because he's not necessarily talking directly about immigration policies at the UN, but somehow they seem related.
Yeah. Being a nationalist doesn't mean that you aren't in favor of immigration. In fact, if you really want to put your country first, then you should be attracting the most and the best talented immigrants. I mean, look at Japan. It's a country that's been in a decades-long slump, partially because it doesn't let in immigrants. And its birth rate right now is so low that it's fast approaching the rate where the population won't even be replaced. Its people are getting older, and there aren't enough young Japanese to pay the pensions of the older ones. So they'll need to bring in immigrants sooner or later. It's not going to be a choice for them. And countries which have let in a lot of immigrants, like the United States, Canada, Australia, they've prospered. I mean, the literature on this is kind of, it's like the literature about climate change. There's a very small minority of economists who question the benefits of immigration. And there really are species of immigration deniers. But, you know, as I said, it's, in the end, I think it's more about emotion than numbers. So it was interesting, after this article came out, I started getting trolled by the white supremacists. And I have never encountered such a kind of volume of abuse as I have after this. They send me emails, they attack me on Twitter. I got trolled by Ann Coulter, which I wear as a badge of honor.
What did Ann Coulter have to say?
She retweeted a white supremacist named Steve Saylor, who was kind of tweeting obsessively about me. And, you know, just this idea that we should let in immigrants. And they were, it took on really extremely personal terms. I mean, a lot of it was directed at my origins. I was born in India and came here when I was 14. All these things telling me to go back to my country. And
so thoughtful commentary on your piece, yes.
Yeah, and and also, this became really interesting. For the first time in my life, I became the target of anti-Semitic abuse. So there were all these people who hate Jews and now hate Indians by association. And I was accused of being part of the global Hindu-Semitic conspiracy. There were people asking me why I didn't change my name as earlier generations of immigrants do. So, I mean, it was really interesting to see how organized these people are on social media and how bitter and fierce and, you know, outright racist they are.
One of the comments I wanted to ask you about, and Beck, I'm curious to hear your thoughts too because of your sort of onboarding comment, but there was an accusation that you had not bothered to change your name. And the criticism was that immigrants who are coming to this country are not trying to be more secular as maybe generations before were trying to be American, adapting to a new country by only speaking in English, about having their kids go to public schools and not maybe celebrating or practicing their own cultures or religions. And that is not a very modern way of thinking, and it certainly goes against the argument that, you know, you are making here, which is that countries benefit by diversity.
I certainly understand why you might want people coming here to learn English, or certainly for their children to learn English and to learn you know, there are certain cultural practices like female genital mutilation, which might be okay where you came from, but aren't okay here. So, you know, I'm not arguing for everyone to stay exactly as they are. I mean, my own family had to change in all kinds of ways, some good, some bad. And so I came to Jackson Heights when I was 14, and there's more languages spoken in that one zip code, which is 11372, than any other in the nation. It might be the most diverse neighborhood in the country. And it was really instructive growing up there because, you know, no one had to be American. Everyone brought their own Americanness with them. And it's flourishing. I mean, there is really almost no ethnic conflict in Jackson Heights. I often take groups of visiting Europeans or South Asians or people from all over the world just walking around Jackson Heights to see that immigration actually works, diversity works. So, you know, these people demanding that we all melt into some sort of American pot, you know, that's nonsense, and it was always nonsense. It was nonsense when the know-nothings demanded this of the Irish, and it was nonsense when people demanded that of the Jewish refugees coming here after the Holocaust. Eventually, people adapt, or even if they don't, their children do. And the great thing about America is that, you know, there's no institution that determines who's American and who's not, which are the 10 cultural values you need to adopt if you need to be American. And this is what makes this country more attractive to most migrants than most of the European nations, which have a far more settled idea of what being British or French means to them.
Yes, but, you know, and so, Becca, that makes me think if we're moving from the idea of what it means to be American, but talking about who is able to come into the country, you were talking about how this was the year that the tradition or the practice of the United States being the country to resettle more refugees was possibly going to come to an end, and how if immigration policy in this country changes the way the Trump administration might have it changed, that it would become un-American, at least as it has been defined in the past.
Yeah, I mean, a huge part of the American identity and a cornerstone of American foreign policy since, I would argue, before World War II, but certainly since the Geneva Convention, has been admitting refugees, admitting people who are persecuted for political or other reasons in their home countries and allowing them to come here. I mean, that's what drove the pilgrims here, was essentially religious persecution. And our refugee admission policy became sort of codified and official in 1980 with the passage of the Refugee Act. And every year at the beginning of the fiscal year, which is now, the U.S. fiscal year, of course, runs through September 30th and the new year starts on October 1st, the president, in consultation with Congress, sets a goal for the number of refugees that America wants to aim to admit in the coming fiscal year. And we don't have an official number from the Trump administration yet, but we're hearing that the maximum it will be is 50,000 and that it could be as low as 10,000. Apparently, Stephen Miller and General Kelly have been arguing for an incredibly low number. And on the flip side, General McMaster, Ambassador Nikki Haley, and General Mattis have been arguing for a higher number, but whatever the number is, it's going to be 50,000 or lower, which will literally be the lowest refugee cap in the history of the United States Refugee Act.
And so you pointed out, too, in the piece in the magazine, that it, with the travel ban and with these potential changes, that this hurts us abroad, and not necessarily just as we stand up against other democratic countries, but also to organizations that seek to undermine and destroy democracy in the countries where they exist, like the Islamic State, and how the travel ban was referred to as the Blessed Ban.
Yes, the Islamic State tweeted about the travel ban that it was the Blessed Ban because it was the best thing that had happened to their recruitment maybe since they took Mosul. I think the more that we create false enemies, the more that we create a self-fulfilling prophecy and the false enemies become real enemies. And I think if we're really serious about fighting the Islamic State and fighting terrorism, we have to have a more nuanced approach than just sort of bloviating at the United Nations and name-calling and, you know, dropping bombs on all the countries We have to engage in diplomacy. We have to take humanitarian action. And we also have to provide support to our allies in the region who are, you know, hosting huge numbers of refugees that are placing an incredible strain on their infrastructure. I think if we want to continue to fly planes out of Turkey to bomb ISIS, we're going to have to do something to help alleviate Turkey of the burden of hosting 2 million Syrian refugees. We have to show that our projection into the region is not simply militaristic. I think similarly, if we want to have any sort of moral voice on things like Bashar Assad using chemical weapons, our response just can't be one of violence. We, you know, suspected him of using chemical weapons a few months ago, and the only response that the U.S. made was to launch 59 Tomahawk missiles at Syrian cities, and there were a number of civilian casualties. And I think it's really hard to be taken seriously as a moral leader trying to deter chemical weapons attacks if our only response to chemical weapons attacks is to launch a bunch of missiles at the sites and kill the civilians. There has to be a humanitarian component of our foreign policy in order to keep the alliances we have in the region that we need to fight the terrorists that we're claiming that we're intending to keep out.
And I'd like to add something. I think we have a moral obligation to many of these refugees who are now afoot in the world because they've left their countries because of us, because of the wars that we have started, because of the drugs that we buy, and because of the mess that we've made of the climate. Americans are responsible for 1/3 of the excess carbon in the atmosphere. We're 4% of the world's population, but we consume 1/4 of its energy and generate 1/2 of its solid waste. So a lot of these people who are on the move, they're on the move because their countries are literally uninhabitable. Like most countries, we have signed international covenants agreeing to take in political refugees. By not taking in refugees, we are flouting the law.
Becca, if I could go back to one thing that you'd said, and you wrote about this both in the piece, you just mentioned it now, which was this notion that, you know, with the targeted travel bans or with a more restrictive refugee policy, it in some ways sort of it marks a repudiation of American tradition or an end of an era or you know, however you want to frame it. But I wonder, though, when we focus on the current debate in the U.S., also in Europe, but this current sort of backlash, whether it's a Brexit, whether it's Hungary, whether it's in Poland, whether it's in the U.S., are we losing sight of, you know, the real history? I mean, if you look back in the U.S. and you look back at the signs, and this was only, you know, 125 years ago, you know, the Irish need not apply. You know, you saw from the huge influx of immigrants coming in around the turn of the century to an immediate change. You had the Chinese Exclusion Acts. You had the Japanese Exclusion Acts. In the 1920s, you had an absolute raft of nativist legislation. In 1938, you had the Jewish refugees on the ships actually turned away from the harbors because there was zero interest whatsoever in harboring them. And my question to you is, is it possible that this sort of post-war Geneva Convention, you know, happy, refugee-friendly America is actually more of an anomaly than what we think it is?
I think it depends how you want to learn from or suffer from your history. I mean, I think you could say America is a nation that was founded on slaves. So why pretend that African Americans should have the same rights as everybody else? Why bother with criminal justice reform? I mean, I think that the fact that America has had nativist policies in the past and that we've reacted poorly to new waves of immigrants doesn't suggest that the American tradition should be one based on discrimination and xenophobia. I think it suggests that we were able to learn from those things, that people were able to integrate into this society and become contributing members, and that in spite of that, we now have incredibly successful people from each of those groups that you've just named, who are leading our country and contributing to our country. And I think that every nation state makes mistakes. But I think to say that we're bound by the mistakes of our history to repeat them over and over, and that has to become our natural culture, national culture, is a really good way to inhibit any forward progress.
Suketu, there's a moment that you reflect on, a memory that you're about your grandfather, an exchange he had while sitting in a park in London, that I think speaks to this perhaps a slightly darker version of facing consequences and how to deal with them of past bad policies or past mistakes of an entire country. But I was wondering if you could share that with us.
Sure. So this is a story about my grandfather once told me. He was born in India and then moved to Kenya in his teens and then to the UK to retire because his son was there. And he was sitting in a park and this elderly English gentleman came up to him and wagged a finger in his face and said, "Why are you here? You should go back to your country." And my grandfather responded, "We are the creditors. You have taken all our gold, our diamonds, you've taken our resources. When you ruled us for 200 years, you stole everything, and we have come here to collect." So this is, you know, he was making a point which is actually buttressed by the evidence that over 200 years of colonialism, the GDP of India plummeted. Before the British came in, it had a much higher share of the world economy. And when they left, there was this deliberate policy of discouraging Indian industries. And essentially, it was this place where raw materials like cotton were shipped to British mills. And then the British sold back the manufactured products to us. So the point my grandfather was making was that colonialism has impoverished large sections of the South. And when these people have no other option but to move to the former colonizers, you know, to look for work, that they don't come as invaders. It's a sort of, you know, you reap what you sow.
Okay. Just before we wrap up our conversation, I wanted to know that sort of facing the end of this year, moving into 2018, and how central these topics are going to be for the politics of the United States, but obviously elsewhere in the world. What's the best way forward?
Well, let me ask you, Becca, because you finished your piece in the magazine on a note like this, which said, you know, it was talking about the necessity of not having an insane and restrictive immigration policy. And then there was a line that said, you know, of course, we can't take every prospective immigrant. And it made me wonder sort of, OK, but where do you draw the line? What criteria do you apply there? And just, you know, if you could even sketch a basic sort of notion of how you would understand that sorting process, that would be great.
I mean, I think there's a number of ways that you could sort people. I think a lot of the ones that we have would be pretty good if they were implemented in a just manner. I think prioritizing people who are fleeing targeted persecution is important. I think prioritizing people who have something economically to add to the United States, and that doesn't necessarily mean like high-skilled labor, but it could mean, you know, people coming in on farm worker visas is important. Prioritizing people with family members in the United States is important. Prioritizing people who have something culturally diverse to add to the United States or to the arts is important. But I think the issue is less about how you categorize and sort people and more about once you have those categories defined, how do you treat people when they're applying to come in? How do you vet them? How do you treat them respectfully in the process and not go into it assuming that everyone from a certain country or of a certain skin color is a terrorist just because they want to come to the U.S., but that people have genuine reasons for wanting to come to America, which is because America is great. And it doesn't need to be made great again by keeping a whole bunch of people out who desire to come in, but by treating everyone who would like to come in fairly and equitably and with respect.
Right. And I would say then that if we look to the end of Suketu's piece, that allowing in and accepting these people into the United States makes America even greater.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of storytelling. The storytelling right now is on the national stage tends to be anti-immigrant, that these people are coming here to take our jobs, to take our women. They are coming here to foe terror. They're literally called rapists and murderers and drug dealers. So, you know, the other kind of storytelling is, you know, something which until this most recent election was the most prevalent story about immigrants, that they come here to make the country vital, that this is the competitive edge we have over other countries which don't let in so many immigrants. And ultimately, it's about individual human beings. You know, the Mexican mother who's come here with her little kids and the kids who grow up not knowing any other country. And what it means on a human novelistic level to throw that family out and send them to a country which the kids have never known. I think there's got to be more of these stories, and ultimately that is what will convince the average voter in Scranton, Pennsylvania, or Milwaukee, or wherever else, that they fear immigrants because they don't know immigrants personally. It's got to be a matter of, for us as writers, as journalists, taking the numbers, explaining rationally why immigration is good for the country, and also creating these portraits of these people and showing that they're here to work and make the country better, not to take something away. They're here to give, not to take.
Well, on that note, I think that we will close up for today. But thank you both so much again for sticking with us and talking to us about this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Rebecca Frankel, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Katie Gardner and Brandon Martini. For more information about FP and to subscribe to The ER and our Global Thinkers and Backstory podcasts, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks very much for joining us.